This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. All right, this first question is actually related to a talk I recently gave. And this is, do you believe anti-Semitism is prevalent and widespread throughout American culture, or is it primarily a European phenomena? I think that it's still true that anti-Semitism is primarily a European phenomena. I think it's rising in the United States and has risen over the last couple of decades, but I still think it's relatively a minor issue. Now, you see anti-Semitism in American colleges among some of the Muslim Student Association members. You see anti-Semitism in some of the advocacy at universities against Israel and to sever the relationships of universities with Israel, boycott certain products from Israel. And I think that is not just anti-Israeli, particularly to Israeli policies. I think that's an extension of anti-Semitism. But clearly Europe is much, much worse, and it's much more severe and much more dangerous for Jews than it would be in America. Generally, the trend is this. The more individualistic a culture, the more capitalist a culture, the freer a culture, the less anti-Semitism there is. America is still, in spite of everything, in spite of all the regulations and the taxes and big government and even the NSA and so on, America still has an individualistic spirit, even if that's not manifest by the government. That spirit is dying, but it's still there to an extent that it's not in Europe. And individualism and anti-Semitism, individualism ultimately, and any kind of racism are incompatible. The more individualistic societies are less anti-Semitic than the collectivist societies. Europe is more anti-Semitic. It's also true that in America, there's still much more respect for achievement. I think a big source of anti-Semitism is envy. It's resentment for the historical fact that Jews have done well. They've succeeded economically. They've succeeded financially. And more in the West, we hate people for their success. So, for example, one place where you saw anti-Semitism in the U.S. was during the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations. And they attracted anti-Semitic elements because they were anti-success. They were anti-achievement. They were anti-wealth. And that almost always goes together with anti-Semitism. If you want much more elaboration on this topic, on the relationship, if you will, between anti-Semitism and envy, anti-Semitism, and capitalism, then I encourage you to watch a video of mine that went up on YouTube a few weeks ago. Just go to YouTube, search anti-Semitism, anti-capitalism, or anti-Semitism in my name, and you will get, I gave a 45-minute lecture on this topic in Los Angeles, which I think you'll find interesting, and we'll expand on the answer I just gave. So this question is about Switzerland. What's my take on the Swiss? They seem to be more successful doing many of the things objectivists advocate, such as limited foreign intervention, a free economy, etc. Well, yes and no. I mean, the Swiss economy is not exactly a free market. It's freer than many countries in Europe. It might even be freer right now than the United States, but they have all kinds of weird regulations and weird controls. Every canton is a little bit different with different regulations because of the way they pass laws in Switzerland. Their limited foreign intervention is much more of a stance of weakness. What would they do if they were actually attacked? Could they even respond? Would they respond? So I don't think Switzerland is a country to be compared with an objectivist ideal, or even to talk about objectivist principles is motivating Switzerland, because I don't think that's true. I don't think they are objectivist principles. And they are freer countries in the world today. I think on the Economic Freedom Index, there are a number of countries out there that also don't intervene internationally, Hong Kong, Singapore, that at least economically significantly freer than Switzerland. But none of them are based on objectivist standards. The objectivist standard for political organization, for government, is the protection of individual rights. On principle, the protection of individual rights. And I don't think that animates the Swiss government. I don't think it animates the Hong Kong government. I don't think it animates any government in the world today. And that's the sad state of the world today. And that, by the way, is what animates an objectivist foreign policy, too. It's the protection of individual rights. It's unlimited foreign intervention. Limited foreign intervention is the outcome. But what the principle is the protection of the rights of Americans. That is, if you pose a threat to Americans, then I don't believe in limited foreign intervention. Then you need to do whatever you need to do to protect the rights of Americans. So limited foreign intervention is not a principle. The protection of individual rights is the principle that animates foreign policy. So there's a recent brouhaha. It appeared in a 60 Minutes story. It's all over the news right now. It's all over the Wall Street Journal. There's a new book out by, I think, Michael Lewis about this high-speed trading. And the idea is the stock market's rigged and that these guys are making a fortune off of the backs of the small investor. And so the question is, what do I think of all this? Do I think the market's rigged? Should high-frequency trading, high-speed trading be made illegal? So let me say, you know, I'm not an expert in this field. I haven't looked at this with great care, but it seems pretty obvious to me that there's no problem here. The problem is completely artificial. Yeah, there's high-speed trading. That's great. It makes the market more efficient, much more faster to reflect information than otherwise. It has lowered the cost of trading in stocks. So all of us benefit enormously. There's no accident that trading in stocks today is, you know, probably, I don't know, 5% of the cost it used to be in the 1970s. Even the 80s, 90s, it's a cost that's continuously being driven down by the introduction of technology into the space of stock trading. So first, I don't see what the problem is here, and I don't see what the issue is here. Yes, people are making money off of small differences in stock prices, and they respond to information very, very, very quickly. Good. That means the information gets embedded in prices very fast, makes the market more efficient. Efficient means reflective of the information that is available to traders. Now, there are issues here, though, but all the issues, all the concerns are really products of regulation. And let me just, you know, so if you delve into this, all of this is a product of the attempts of the SEC to what they call level the playing field, to basically disenfranchise the stock exchanges from setting rules and regulations that would dictate how stocks are traded and standardizing them around the SEC's standards. So, you know, for example, it used to be that if you listed on the NYSE, you could only trade the stock on the NYSE. And there wasn't this ability to arbitrage, this minute arbitrages between the NASDAQ and the NSD and other exchanges. But my understanding is that today, if you list in NYSE, you have to be able to trade that stock on any exchange. That's ridiculous. What you want is exchanges to compete. What you want is exchanges to compete on the way in which the exchange privately regulates the way the particular stocks are being traded. In that sense, I don't believe there should be any restrictions on short selling. There should be any restrictions on insider trading except the responsibilities of managers, their fiduciary responsibilities to shareholders, or any contractual relationships between shareholders and managers. But exchanges should then be able to say, you want to trade on our exchange? Here are the insider trading rules you have to abide by, let's say. Or here are the rules in terms of, I don't know, speed or how it's traded, or the mechanism of trade, or the commissions being paid. It doesn't matter. And then let them compete. Let different exchanges list different stocks and compete on how the trading happens, and let the best people win. And the problem here is that the system is rigged, but the system is rigged by the SEC in the name of leveling the playing field. And whenever the SEC creates a regulation, whenever it attempts to so-called level the playing field or do anything else, it creates inefficiencies in the market, and players will enter into the market to take advantage of those. And that's what the high-frequency trader, the high-speed traders are doing right now. They're basically entering into the market to take advantage of ridiculous standards and regulations that standardize across all platforms that the SEC has put together. Whenever you see a story about something that looks a little fishy in financial markets, I will guarantee you that behind it is some ridiculous, stupid regulation of the SEC or some other government entity. They're the ones destroying the markets. Markets don't behave in ways that are disadvantageous in fundamental ways to the customers and the suppliers and the participants in the marketplace. There is a blog post on ARI.aynrand.org, which covers some of this issue and links to an excellent Wall Street Journal editorial, which kind of lists and describes some of the regulations that are the causes of some of these problems. So this whole idea that the market rigs it, there's a stock market being rigged, the market's not rigged. It's more open, in some senses, too open, I would argue, to individual traders to trade cheaply and easily than it's ever been. Whatever distortions there are in the market right now, whatever so-called market failures there are in the market right now, whatever opportunities there are to profit in the market that shouldn't be there, if you will, all of those are caused by regulations. And the solution would be to get rid of all the SEC regulations, ultimately to get rid of the SEC itself. So this is a question, I think, following up on the Bitcoin question that I did a few weeks ago. And the question here is, could Bitcoin or an equivalent to Bitcoin, some digital currency in a sense, be put on the gold standard so that it would be redeemable into gold guaranteed by some institution? And yeah, of course. And I think this is actually what would happen in a free market. I think Bitcoin, in other words, digital currencies are great, but only to the extent that they're redeemable, only to the extent that they are backed by some physical commodity. And you could imagine in a free market, I don't think this is possible today because the government would shut it down as soon as you started it, but because they could confiscate the gold, so they could confiscate what's behind it, so they would destroy the marketplace immediately. But in a free market, banks would hold, I assume, gold. It could be another commodity. I've nothing, you know, nothing in favor of gold other than history suggests that that is in history, and I think logic suggests that it's the best, but let the market determine this. I mean, I might be wrong. Let there be competition in currencies and let's see what currency wins. The banks, let's say, would hold some kind of gold reserve, and then they would issue, instead of paper currency, instead of pieces of paper, they would issue bitcoins, they were equivalents, right? They would issue a digital bit, and you would go and you could use this anonymously, and anybody who got this bit from you would know that they could send it at some point to the original bank and get in its place gold. And that would instantaneously legitimize and stabilize the value of these bits and give them credibility across the entire market. Because if I was a storekeeper and somebody paid with, call it bit something, I could then take that bit something and send it into, let's say, J.P. Morgan, and J.P. Morgan would credit my account with so many ounces of gold, or J.P. Morgan would ship me the gold bar, whatever it was, however, whatever the mechanism was. And therefore, I would have no hesitation to take the bit because I would know that there was an institution that legally, contractually had committed to backing this digital currency with a physical commodity. And in those cases, I actually think a digital currency would dominate all other currencies because more and more of our life is shifting to the web. I can imagine waving my iPhone in front of the cash register and the digital currency paying for all my goods. Why would you have a credit card? Why would you need anything other than some vessel in which you could carry this bit currency and transfer to anybody? Again, all merchants would take it because ultimately it would be redeemable by some entity out there, some entity that was, again, contractually obligated to do so into a physical commodity.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peakoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.